If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When sweet tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like sweet tarts twisted rainbow ropes, gummies fruity splits, and chewy fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet tarts, dare to combine. Visit sweettartscandy.com to shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Hans Holbein the Younger's paintings were so realistic that when people saw his life-sized mural of Henry VIII at Whitehall Palace, they jumped with fright, thinking that the king was in the room with them. For today's podcast, our sub-editor Rhiannon Davies spoke to Franny Moyle, who's released a new book exploring the mesmerising artworks that Holbein created, as well as the turbulent times he lived through.
So my first question is a really simple back to basics one, and it is, who was Hans Holbein and what period did he live in?
So Hans Holbein the Younger was born in 1497 and he died in 1543. So he was living at a time which I suppose most historians would now call the sort of early modern period. And he was really one of the most celebrated, if not the most celebrated, artist in Northern Europe during his lifetime, who travelled from his homeland on the continent to become Henry VIII's court painter, the king's painter. And it is really through Holbein's eyes, I think, that we see Henry VIII's court today. All those pictures of Henry VIII, if one imagines the king, it's probably Holbein's depiction of him that will pop into your mind's eye.
And you say in your book that his work shows the Tudor world like no other. Why do you think this is?
Well, Holbein had terrific access to the most significant men and women of his day. So what he provides us with, certainly in terms of the English court, is a really up-close and personal view of the leading men and women. And he was such a fine portrait artist, and his paintings are so lifelike. So in a way, you really are face to face with long-lost monarchs, queens, courtiers, movers and shakers. So I think that is one aspect of his work that reveals the Tudor world, his work in England. But if you sort of take his entire career, his work tells the story of Europe transforming at that time as well, because he started, like so many artists, as someone painting devotional work for traditional Catholic clients. And as the what we now call the Protestant Revolution swept across Europe, it sort of swept Holbein with him, and his whole work had to change and adapt, essentially away from the religious works he had painted, if you like, in a Catholic Germany and a Catholic Switzerland, to the more secular art that he develops for Protestant clients. Protestant, obviously, is an anachronism, but for want of a better word, and a secular art that served the purposes of Henry's court.
You mentioned that his paintings are very lifelike, and this is something that you really bring to life in your book. You really hammer home that paintings were the main way that people would see people they'd never met, and the fact that his paintings are so realistic was something that seemed to be quite rare at the time and was really celebrated. Do you think that's one of the reasons why he was such a popular painter?
Without a doubt. I mean, Holbein's paintings today, if you can get to see some of them, and there are some in the National Gallery, for example, if you can get to have a look face-to-face with Holbein's paintings, I guarantee you a tingle will go down your spine. Because it's not that his painting was lifelike in comparison to most of the art of the time. His painting in the whole history of art is some of the most lifelike we have ever enjoyed. He is, you know, one of the greatest artists in that respect. But I think the other thing that people need to think is to try and cast themselves back in time into what painting was like back in the 16th century. I mean, for a start, today we're so used to being able to go to galleries. We see everything in reproduction. We're surrounded by television and magazine and books, and paintings feel very accessible. But then they were rare. People would see them in church. They would see them in public buildings. And if people were wealthy, they would be able to commission paintings. So they were much more like sort of precious jewellery. They would have been considered an event. Quite often they were concealed in cabinets or books, and you'd open shutters or draw back a curtain to look at them. And so if you think of that, if you think of the rarity of seeing a painting, and then a curtain is drawn back and you see something that is really lifelike, that would have been a real novelty, a real event, a real shock to the system for Holbein's original clientele.
Holbein isn't the only painter in his family. His father, Hans Holbein the Elder, is incredibly famous in his own right. What's their relationship like?
Holbein was part of a long-established family of artists, if you like, or craftspeople. His father was indeed Hans Holbein the Elder, who was a really successful painter in Bavaria, where Holbein was born. They were based, Hans Holbein the Elder and his workshop was based in the city of Augsburg. And he was one of the most celebrated painters of his day. His work was nearly all devotional work, religious work for the religious institutions. And of course, his influence on Holbein was immense in lots of ways. I mean, at a very simple level, he was trained by his father. Holbein the Younger was trained by Holbein the Elder. He would have worked as a small boy in his workshop, grinding pigments. This is long before paints just came in tubes. Grinding pigments, washing brushes, prepping wood, because people were painting largely on wood then. So providing a ground on it. So he learnt the skills of his trade very early on from his father. But I think his father gave him much more than just the basic sort of toolkit. His father was the most wonderfully playful artist, and he spent a lot of effort trying to make his religious work accessible to the widest possible audience. And he did this by using very sort of playful techniques where he would almost compress time, where he'd fuse the biblical world he was portraying with the contemporary world. So, for example, in an altarpiece he painted for St. Afra, which is now in Basel's museum, he paints the Virgin, it's the death of the Virgin, and he paints the Virgin wearing a contemporary fabric so that she feels proximate. And it's a very costly contemporary fabric. So it signals, you know, her importance, her preciousness. But also in that picture, there's a rosary hanging on the wall, which is, of course, an anachronism because this is long before rosaries. We're in, you know, the biblical era. So, you know, this he compresses the then and the now. And in doing that, he pulls, you know, the people of Augsburg in 1498 or whenever they were viewing that particular work into the biblical past. Now, Holbein the Younger would expand on that idea of perspective and compression and different dimensions fusing together. I mean, the other thing his father was really notable for was he was a portrait artist. Now, portraiture was only really emerging, you know, in Holbein the Elder's era. And Holbein the Elder was a very good portrait artist, and he not only made portraits of some of the noble men and women of Augsburg, but he made sure that his religious works were filled with characterful faces, which undoubtedly he drew from life. And again, that skill of looking and seeing and capturing something that feels really lifelike was seeded by the father in the son. I think in terms of their relationship, I think it was a complex one. There is some evidence that Holbein the Elder really understood how supremely talented his young son was, and was in fact something of a child prodigy. And this is suggested by the fact that he paints portraits of his son Little Hans into some of his religious works. And he does so in such a way that really draws attention to this young child, as if saying, hey guys, here he is. Remember the prodigy from Augsburg, my son? There's a very famous depiction of this that Holbein the Elder painted in 1504 when Hans would have been seven. And it's in a religious painting, and it's in a scene when St. Paul is being baptized. And Holbein the Elder paints himself and his two sons, because Hans had a brother called Ambrosius. But Holbein the Elder is pointing at Holbein the Younger, and Ambrosius is embracing him. So the whole family is sort of focusing on this little boy. But one of the discoveries I made was that there was a portrait smuggled into a painting even 2 years earlier by Hans Holbein the Elder, of a five-year-old Hans Holbein the Younger. And this time he stands solo in the centre of a composition in a memorial painting, the Walther Memorial. And again, there is this terrific focus on this little boy. And so I think that cannot just be an indication that his father adored him. It has to say something about this child was already showing some sort of exceptional talent. So I think Holbein the Elder adored his son and saw him as, if you like, the workshop's great future, the Holbein workshop's great future. This was the boy who could, you know, take the family to new heights. The tragedy, though, of their relationship is that Holbein the Elder belonged to a generation of artists that, despite their brilliance, were quite sort of low down, if you like, on the social ladder. And they were poorly paid. They were really exploited by patrons. And a lot of them fell into debt. I mean, they really struggled. Holbein the Elder's direct contemporary was Albrecht Dürer, you know, the other great painter of the Northern Renaissance. And he actually said, I'm going to give up painting and just work on prints, because painting, I just can't make ends meet. And certainly by the time Hans Holbein the Younger was in his teens, his father was in terrible debt, and he had to actually leave Augsburg with sort of his creditors sort of pursuing him. And so there is some tragedy in that relationship. I suspect, you know, Holbein the Younger was so driven, he was so ambitious. And of course, that is partly because he was just a talented and compelled artist. But I think also there was this terrible strain to earn money and not die a practical pauper like his father.
One of the key themes of your book is humanism. For any of our listeners who aren't familiar with this, can you very briefly tell us what humanism is?
So Holbein the Younger was born into a moment when humanism was becoming very popular in Germany, where he was born, and elsewhere on the continent. And humanism was a movement really about rediscovering the classical past, an interest in the classical past, both in terms of classical literature, but also in terms of excavations and rediscovery. So in a way, humanism and the Renaissance go hand in hand in their interests in a classical past and what one could learn from a classical past, what the literature and the remnants of the antique might offer a modern world in terms of philosophy and so on and so forth. So what we get in the way that translates, if you like, into artistic practice at that time was, for example, the interest in portraiture. The excavations across Europe had thrown up loads of little Roman medallions and portraits, again, all very lifelike. And so suddenly the interest in verisimilitude, the ability to create lifelike works of art, grew. And those who could afford art, it was always a precious commodity, you know, wanted little portrait medallions cast. They wanted their portrait painted. I mean, the other influence we get, of course, is classical motifs, classical imagery, particularly in architecture, for example. And you get that emerging as well. So, you know, portraiture, a particular type of motif, verisimilitude, but also, of course, an interest in Latin stories and Latin texts. Those all bubble through and they all sort of emerge in Holbein's work.
And one of the key figures of humanism is Erasmus, and he is Holbein's first major patron. How does this benefit Holbein?
Yes, Erasmus is one of his major patrons, but possibly, arguably, the most important early patron. It's hard to understand just how famous Erasmus was today. I mean, you know, he was an old monk, a former monk and scholar. And in a way, those are not terms that we equate with popularity today. I hope monks and scholars forgive me for saying so. But Erasmus was a superstar. He was a scholar who mined classical texts, retranslated them, republished them, provided commentaries on them. But there were sort of two sides to his output. One side was incredibly erudite and important work on classical translations of the Bible, commentaries on the Gospels and so on and so forth, and on the church, and on how people should behave. You know, he wrote essays and books on, you know, how Christianity should modernize itself, what the true meaning, you know, how Christian kings and Christian soldiers should behave. But on the flip side, he had a wonderful sense of humour. He was a sort of satirist, and he wanted to be popular and famous. So he wrote a book called Adages, which was very, very popular, where he found all the old sayings and repurposed them for the new generation. So, you know, a rolling stone gathers moss. So, you know, these sorts of things that are all part of our sort of phraseology today. And that was very successful. The other publication by Erasmus that was incredibly popular was In Praise of Folly, which was a sort of satirical commentary on the stupidness of mankind. And a lot of it had a real go at the Catholic Church, because although Erasmus was a devoted Catholic and remained devoted to the Catholic Church throughout his life, nevertheless, he saw it needed reform. He was fully aware that there were many issues with the Catholic Church. And In Praise of Folly has a real go at, you know, some of the what Erasmus saw as the stupidities and corrupt elements of the church. So he was very, very, very famous. And in one of those wonderful sort of miracles of coincidence, Erasmus and Holbein found themselves in the same city, which was Basel in Switzerland, or Baal in Switzerland, around 1516. Erasmus had just issued a new edition of In Praise of Folly. Holbein, desperate to make a mark, said, "Can I illustrate it?" Did little sort of ink interpretations, little vignettes, which Erasmus loved. And then some years later, when Erasmus found himself back in that city in Baal, suddenly he commissioned Holbein a whole series of portraits that went off around the world, a new device which became an emblem that was reproduced in Erasmus's publications. And so in a way, the association at that point between Erasmus and Holbein really served Holbein well. But, you know, it raised his profile considerably.
And he opens lots of doors for Holbein, doesn't he? Because he's instrumental in Holbein going to England.
Absolutely. Holbein would not have, well, we don't know if Holbein would have got to England without Erasmus, but he certainly went to England with Erasmus's help. Erasmus knew everybody. He knew all the kings, princes, queens of Europe. And when Holbein decided he wanted to try his luck in England, he went to Erasmus, and Erasmus gave him a whole series of introductory letters, not only that would help his journey across Europe, so he had places to stay and so on and so forth, but that gave him an introduction to some of the most important people in the Tudor court, not least Sir Thomas More, who was a great, great friend of Erasmus's. And so in 1526, when Holbein first came to England, he turned up at Chelsea, where Sir Thomas More was living, and became part of More's household. And it was a sort of fast track, basically, into the Tudor court.
And before we come on to explore Holbein's time in the Tudor court, I'd really like to go back ever so slightly and look at his reasons for deciding to leave. So as you mentioned in a previous answer, the Protestant Reformation is sweeping across Europe. So in Basel, where Holbein is living, there is this big rise in more evangelical Protestantism, and he feels like he has to leave. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
So in 1517, Martin Luther pinned his theses to the doors of a church in Wittenberg. Now, Martin Luther was a scholar and a monk. And as I'm sure your audience will know, he saw there were huge issues with the Catholic Church. And his railing against the church in these theses, his condemnation of the way they raised money through indulgences and so on and so forth, began what we now understand as the Reformation, as the the rise of what we now call Protestantism. Now, in 1517, Holbein was just 20 and not so far away. He was in Basel in Switzerland by this point, where he'd moved after the Holbein workshop closed in Augsburg. And it wasn't that long before versions of Lutheranism spread across Europe. And it wasn't that long before in Basel, its own version of Protestantism emerged. It was being felt, I suppose, in the early 1520s. There's evidence, of preachers, pro-reform preachers in Basel. Tensions in the city were emerging. In the early 1520s, Basel was dominated by traditional Catholics. By that I mean those in power, the members of the council, and so on and so forth. And Holbein's main clientele, because they were moneyed, were traditional Catholics. But as Protestantism arose, there was a lot of rioting and unrest, and essentially Holbein's patrons fled. They went to more friendly cities where their houses weren't going to get sort of ransacked and where they weren't going to get abused. And the other tragedy for Holbein was not only did all the clients he'd built up, all the money people, disappear, but Protestantism took real issue with what it saw as the worshipping of idols, that what it saw as a fault in the Catholic Church, that every saint, had his or her painting or statue, and that people would worship at the foot of these saints without really thinking what that meant. It had become a ritual rather than a process of contemplation. And so there was a movement to remove these sort of what they considered Catholic idols. And so, Holbein's work, we imagine, was being pulled down, burnt, hidden. We know some of his greatest paintings, religious paintings, were literally hidden away out of view. So it was an incredibly difficult time for him to operate just as a business. Suddenly, painters were out of work in a way. And the other thing is, with Protestantism came a sort of aesthetic that was, rather plain, simple. No good Protestant was going to commission a fancy portrait. That would have been considered a bit too indulgent. So all aspects of his career were under threat. Whereas in England at that time, in the 1520s, England was still a good old Catholic country, completely untouched by the Reformation. And so Holbein saw England as a place where he could work.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And I think Holbein was trying to convey, perhaps to Henry, something about the character of Anne of Cleves. I have no doubt that the way he portrayed her is how she looked. Factually, physically, that is an accurate portrait.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA Playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA Playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And coming on to England, how does Holbein first catch the eye of Henry VIII and work his way up to becoming the king's painter?
When Holbein arrived in England with letters of recommendation from Erasmus in his pocket, he went immediately to Sir Thomas More, who immediately said, "I will do whatever I can to help you." So he was really under the eye, you know, he was at the centre of Henry's court from the off, in a way, because Henry's relationship with More at that point in 1526 was a very positive one. There are accounts that Henry would visit More's house in Chelsea, where Holbein, we think, was resident at that time. So, you know, there was a good chance for Henry to see Holbein's work. He did a portrait of More. He did a portrait of More and his family. He may well have painted some religious paintings for More's chapel. He may have had, you know, there may have been other elements going on in More's house that Henry could have seen. But what we do know is that almost instantly, within weeks of Holbein's arrival in London and at Chelsea, Henry was preparing to receive some French ambassadors, and he wanted to stage a huge magnificence, a sort of wonderful festivity. He planned jousting, a huge banqueting hall where there would be a most lavish feast, and then a theatre where there'd be a wonderful pageant. And his plan was to build temporary structures, a temporary banqueting hall and a temporary theatre. And this would, for the spring of 1527, to impress the French. This was a time when, you know, if we think this is only 7 years after the Field of the Cloth of Gold, this is a moment where transient magnificence was really important. The ability to conjure from a sort of muddy field a sort of magnificent, awe-inspiring structure was almost more impressive than inviting someone to an extant palace, in a way. And Holbein was set to work almost, you know, practically as soon as he landed. We think he arrived in the sort of autumn winter of 1526. You know, by February 1527, he was hard at work on the festivities. Probably because Sir Thomas More's brother-in-law was the producer, or one of the producers of them. And so, again, he'd just been at the right place in the right time. You know, everyone could see his talent. He would have brought his portfolio with him, and probably his fame preceded him as well. So there was Holbein. And so he was commissioned very initially to do these very important diplomatic festivities for the king. And he did two things. For the banqueting hall, he did a huge standalone painting of the English defeating the French at a particular battle, which is kind of strange. And there was this sort of trick that the hall was constructed with a sort of arch at one end, and everyone had their sumptuous banquet. And then as they were being led, as the diplomats were being led into the next sort of stage of the event, which was to go to the theatre, they went through the arch, and Henry asked them to pause and turn round. And as they turned round, they saw this huge painting of the French defeat, the Battle of the Spurs, behind them, and it took their breath away. Now, there's no schematic, no drawings of this that survive. But knowing Holbein's brilliance, not only at capturing people, but also at creating perspectival illusion, trompe l'oeil. He could make sort of magical buildings appear real. And, you know, you sort of reach and touch them and you realize they're not real. That space isn't there. He was a master of illusion. So one imagines that what they saw was this sort of really persuasive image of a battlefield receding perhaps away from them, that the French said was, you know, it was as if they were there again. And then as the French progressed, they went into the banqueting hall where Holbein had created this huge ceiling with a sort of map of the world and the stars, probably with different layers of gauze. So you might have had sort of stars and different elements of astrological elements, or, you know, elements of the zodiac layered over a sort of atlas, which again was apparently breathtaking. So, you know, Henry was in the center of Holbein's brilliance from the moment Holbein arrived in London.
And the Protestant Reformation does catch up with Holbein when he's in England. How does he navigate the constant changing of who's in favor, who's out of favor? Because Henry's court is quite a dangerous place to be. If you're a favorite of Henry, it might not always turn out well for you. How does he manage to stay on almost everyone's good side?
I think it's worth reminding people, and this was something that when I embarked on my book, I hadn't really fully appreciated, was that just how mercurial Henry VIII was when it came to religion. I mean, one equates the Reformation with Henry VIII, but really Henry VIII remained a devoted Catholic his entire life, and it was a sort of pragmatic politics, in a way, his desire to marry Anne Boleyn, that forged the English church as a way of sidelining the Pope. But from that moment on, you know, when he sort of created this new Church of England in order to enable a marriage, although reformers saw this as an opportunity for reform, Henry would just go one way and another. One minute he was pro-reform, the next minute he wasn't. And there are lots of, and I'm simplifying this a little bit, but, you know, there were lots of accounts at the time that the general populace didn't know whether they were coming or going. They didn't know whether they'd have their heads cut off for being anti-Pope or whether they'd have their, you know, heads cut off for being pro-Pope. It could, you know, depending which day it was, Wednesday or Tuesday. So Holbein entered this sort of maelstrom of factionalism, which Henry one moment was pro one faction, next moment pro another. I think he navigated it in a number of ways. I think he was a brilliant politician with a small p, or diplomat. He must have been charming. And I suspect that's something he learnt from his father. Henry talks about my beloved Holbein. When Holbein's uncle dies in his uncle Sigmund dies in his will, he talks about, again, my most beloved, you know, Holbein. So that he must have been incredibly charismatic. And I think that was helpful. But the other thing, so charisma, really, though, non-partisan. I think Holbein kept his own beliefs incredibly close. And again, as I'm saying, I think that's part of his skill as a diplomat. He painted both sides of the fence the whole time. Art was work. It wasn't about being part of a faction. I also think he built a lot of ambiguity into his work. I mean, he does. He is responsible for, both in England and in Basel, arguably pro-Lutheran imagery. And yet, you could always see him arguing his way out and saying, no, I'm mocking Luther here. This isn't pro, this is me satirizing him. There was also, in his work, enough space that the meaning of the work could rest in the eye of the beholder, if you see what I mean. He was incredibly clever like that in building ambiguity into his work. So, you know, I think he could wriggle round and navigate the factionalism of the court, be it political or religious. And he must have been a master at that, I have to say, because it was toxic, that court.
And there are two paintings of his in particular that I'd like to get your insights into. And the first one is the mural that he paints at Whitehall Palace. And this shows the Tudor dynasty. So obviously Henry VIII is included in that. And you write about this in such an engaging way. Could you tell us how he presents this monarch in this painting?
The great image that I bet your listeners will know of Henry by Holbein was one that belonged to a mural that, alas, was burnt down in the 17th century with the Palace of Whitehall when that burned. The great figure of Henry standing with his hands sort of just in front of his hips, his great big wide shoulders, looking straight out, his sort of feet wide apart. He's like Atlas. That image was the image devised of Henry for a great mural in the Palace of Whitehall. It was really the pinnacle of Holbein's career, this commission. I mean, Whitehall was Henry's project in the early 1530s. It was the palace he was planning to be the most impressive, you know, palace, his centre in London. And this was for the very sort of inner sanctum of the palace. And it was a huge mural showing Henry, his father and his father on one side, Henry's mother and his wife of that time, Jane Seymour, on the other. And they are arranged around a sort of stone monument on which it's engraved. There's a sort of engraving that invites the viewer to consider, you know, who is the greatest, the father or the son, i.e. who should stand on the monument. It's as if they're all standing round and there's a sort of space waiting for a statue to go up. It was life-size. The figures in this mural were life-size. And again, so realistic. And the figure of Henry, so terrifying, apparently, that people would do a double take. You know, when they came in, they thought it was real. They thought they'd bumped into the king. They were terrified. And then, of course, this was the great thing about Holbein, you know, this trickery. He was called cunning. He was so persuasive, his art, that you thought you were looking at a portion of the room and you thought the king was there. And then you would realise, oh my goodness, no, it's just a painting of the king. But there would be that moment when art impinged on the real world, if you like, where what I call in my book the sort of imaginative space, you know, between what's real and not sort of is engaged. It's an interesting painting, not only because you can see Holbein working to create this figure of majesty and power in the figure of Henry. The cartoon for this mural does exist. It's currently on show at the National Gallery, actually, though often it's technically part of the National Portrait Gallery collection. And you can see in the cartoon, Henry is in three-quarter profile. His face is in three-quarter profile. But by the time he came to paint the mural, he turned Henry's face, so it was full face, much more intimidating. And he's the only figure full face. It's quite interesting. So it draws your attention to him. So I think in answer to the question on the, you know, pedestal or the sort of stone monument, because you're drawn to Henry, because of his stance, because he's like Atlas, I think we all know the answer, who is the greater, who's going to stand on the monument. Well, it's going to be Henry. But there are other strange things about that mural. I mean, it is a very, again, it doesn't exist anymore, but it exists that artists made copies of it. So we know what it looks like. And this sort of great big slab of stone in the middle of it, compositionally, is very peculiar. And my view, and this is only my view, is that it is a some sort of memento mori, a reminder of death. Because although on the one hand, this is a plinth for a statue of the greatest Tudor monarch, it also looks like a tomb. So this is also a reminder, I think, that, no one lives forever, even if their reputation and a painting of them persists. Holbein, you know, p- puts lots of hidden meanings and sort of symbolic layers into his work. And, you know, that painting is not short of them. It's very interesting that just below Henry, there's a little frieze of a figure of the god of war, Mars. The figure has been cut off at the waist because of the architectural arrangement. But again, there's an implication perhaps there that whilst the figure is supposed to sort of reinforce this terrifying image of Henry, it's also slightly emasculated. Again, this is what I mean about ambiguity. Surely Holbein would not dare suggest that his great patron was in some way lacking. And surely if Henry said, why is Mars cut off at the waist, Holbein would be able to say, oh, well, sir, it's to show that you're standing on a podium, you know.
You talked about ambiguity in his paintings, and one that can be read in so many different ways is his painting of Anne of Cleves, which I imagine most of our listeners, if you say the name Hans Holbein the Younger, you'll think of that picture of Anne of Cleves. How does he put in clues about what her personality might be like?
The painting of Anne of Cleves is often just considered in isolation, but in fact it was one of a series of paintings that Holbein had made across sort of 1838 and 39, when Henry was looking for a new wife after Jane Seymour had died. Jane Seymour had died in 1537 after giving birth to Henry's son. Cromwell, Henry's chief advisor at that point, was very keen that Henry didn't marry another English lady, but actually make a political marriage. And Henry was very much up for this. There was a good reason at that time to forge an alliance because of the political map of Europe at the time. So Holbein had actually gone and painted a Habsburg princess, Christina of Denmark, the Duchess of Milan, same person. He had also painted a number of French princesses, Mary of Guise and her sisters. He had also painted the Princess of Lorraine. He'd been all over Europe. And so Henry had this sort of collection of beauties, of which Anne of Cleves was the last. And by the time that the painting of Anne of Cleves arrived, actually, the possibility of the other wives had fallen away, I have to say. He'd been turned down by Christina. Mary of Guise had married the King of Scotland. Her other sisters were unavailable. You know, it sort of goes on. So he'd been very disappointed. Now, I say it was one of a series because I think it refers to the other portraits. It certainly refers in a way to the portrait of Christina of Denmark, which showed a woman in completely simple widow's clothing, a plain black silk coat, a hood. She's in the National Gallery if you want to look at her. She is beautiful. And she is shown in three-quarter profile, her gloves twisting in her hands in this very plain black garment. And yet she is so vivacious because the contrast is so great between her plain robes and her vivacious expression that you know that Christina was something. You know she was a character. Anne, by contrast, is shown laden, bejeweled with this heavy, ornate headdress and, you know, the most ornate costume. And her face, by contrast, is expressionless. What's more is it's full. She's not in three-quarter profile, i.e. with dimension. She is shown face on, almost two-dimensional, without dimension. And I think Holbein was trying to convey, perhaps, to Henry something about the character of Anne of Cleves. I have no doubt that the way he portrayed her is how she looked. You know, factually, physically, that is an accurate portrait. But I think the choice of showing her heavily laden in jewels, so that your attention is more on the packaging, and it suggests that it's more she is more of a package and less of a person, if you see what I mean. And the fact that she's shown in this very unusual full face aspect, I think that suggests she lacks dimension. And indeed, all the notes that were sent by Henry's ambassadors and diplomats at the time, you know, said, you know, she's lovely and she's compliant, but, you know, she doesn't play instruments and she can't speak English, and she doesn't really have a sense of humour. And so there was a hint, you know, all along. And I think the painting is complicit. You know, I think it also offers that hint. But like all these things, I think Holbein paints enough ambiguity into the painting that Henry can see what he wants. You know, the warning is there, in my view, from Holbein, that here is a woman without much character, or at least whose character has been subsumed by, you know, the way she's been brought up at court, and she's just sort of compliant. Well, that might be a good thing. She's a blank canvas. But he also paints her in an aspect, this sort of full frontal aspect, that was, if any woman was painted like that, it tended to be the Virgin Mary. And this was a time when Henry had a young child without a mother. And so I think there might have also been a suggestion at some level that, well, you know, in spite of her, you know, in spite of the fact she's a bit vanilla, she's rather bland, nevertheless, she would be an appropriate mother. So I think he's offering the king, you know, a number of interpretations to cherry pick, and Henry just went for it.
And for my final question, what would you say Holbein's legacy is?
I think he has a number of legacies. I mean, for the historian, Holbein gives us a window into the Tudor court and into 16th century Europe. Through Holbein's work, we can meet the greatest people on the continent, Erasmus, in the English court, Henry and his courtiers. And as you know, that in itself is astonishing, to be able to see these people as they were, in the garments they chose to be seen, holding the items that were important to them to signify their successes or their likes and dislikes, what there was on their mind. I think, if you like, in terms of his legacy to the history of art, his skill, not only as a portraitist, able to draw with and paint with the most astonishing verisimilitude, he was a perspectival genius. He took perspective, and here you must think about the ambassadors and the floating skull, which, you know, snaps into perspective when you stand at a particular in a particular point in relation to the painting. He experimented with dimension in a way that I think was outstanding in his time. And I talk a lot about that in the book, because I think he paints time as well as dimension. We can't really go into that now, but so I think, as a technical and conceptual, if you like, artist, he was astounding in his exploration of dimension and man's place in space and in time and in the moment. He also, his legacy for English art, and I have to say English, I wish I could say British, but it was at a time when, you know, England and Scotland and you know, were very separate, and he was at the English court, not at a British court. But in terms of English art, you know, Holbein was one of the first great named painters. He took English art out of the medieval era, where painters, you know, didn't sign their work by and large, where their names are not really known, where they weren't considered geniuses. And he became celebrated. He was written about by the poets of his time, by his peers. He was our Leonardo, if you like. And he established a status for the artist, which hadn't really existed in England before that time.
That was Franny Moyle. Her new book, The King's Painter, The Life and Times of Hans Holbein, is out now, published by Apollo. You can find a link in our show notes. And there's plenty more on Henry VIII and the Tudors at our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow when Stephen Johnson will be speaking about his new BBC series, Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer.